Father, thank you that you speak into all areas of our life. Would you do that this morning in a realm that we don't think too much about, apart from the groaning of it or the burden of we just got to do it? Would you remind us that you've given us work as one of your good gifts? Would you help us taste a little bit more of that goodness as we go about our daily tasks? Be with us now as we reflect on how people have viewed work throughout history. Help us learn from it. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, I'm going to have to improvise a little bit here. I had two helpers this morning. Maybe I could just... Knox and Zwingli were going to help me out this morning. Two little puppets. One was Shrek. His name was Knox. I left my bag at home. I can't believe it. It would have been so fun. And Zwingli was the other fellow, the other character. And he was, I don't know what duck it was, but a little yellow duck with a little tuft on his hair. They'll come into play a little bit later. Maybe I'll try to be a duck and Shrek. I don't know if I can do that. But why don't you? That could be fun. All right. Well, before we get there, let's just review, because otherwise you'll be so distracted you won't be paying any attention to what I'm saying. It'll be fun, I promise. But let's just take a moment to review. You remember that we're dealing with work and leisure. So we looked at some broader definitions. Work is that which you must do. A leisure is that which you're not obliged to do. A lot broader than that. But and looking at work particularly, maybe the first half of the class is really work was designed as a good gift from God for His glory and for our joy. As the original purpose. We looked at that early on. Was it last week already? No, that last week was the twistingness. But work is God's good gift. God Himself is a worker. You know, He gets His hands dirty. 6 days He works as He creates. And even the ongoing work of caring, His providence. And that raises the dignity of all our work too then. Where work is not a burden, but it's something that God Himself does, and we can image Him in that. We image Him in a multitude of ways, creating, designing, thinking, gardening, and so on. The purpose of work is to honor God by loving our neighbor and serving them through our work. Then last week we looked at work twisted, really looking at Genesis 2 and I guess Genesis 3 really, and a little bit of Ecclesiastes, where we saw that mankind's work gets twisted. Now work is associated with toil, with burden, with pain. That's both men and women. All of our tasks now have a negative twist to them. They're no longer simply satisfying and enjoying. They have those things are culled back to a fair degree. The ground itself gets twisted. Now the earth resists, and eventually the earth even swallows man back up. When we die, we return to dust. So earth, the ground gets twisted. And then work for God's glory gets twisted. And we'll see how these guys work. Neither look particularly intellectual, but alright. There we go. Anticipate, okay? Just anticipate. They'll be gone by sermon time, I promise. So work gets twisted, and the vertical dimension, because Adam and Eve were cast out of the garden, all of the good design of, or much of the good design of work is unraveled. From man's side, I should say. Where now we experience futility and pointlessness. Ecclesiastes kind of decries the fact that when we die, we can barely even say where our stuff is going to go. We can tell people what we want done with it, but we can't control it. It's beyond us. And perhaps someone who's going to abuse all that we worked so hard for is going to take it. But there's a futility to work. And the work apart from God means that we twist work now for our own purposes, for our selfishnesses. The idea of idolatry, where now work is used to give us a name, or to form for ourselves a security, a reputation, the idea that we're in control. We can control life if you have enough money and so on. So that's just a very brief review, work twisted by the fall. Today I want to step back into history and just take a look back at how they did it. How did others before us view work? Maybe some covering hundreds of years in a sentence. I hope you'll bear with me for that. But what I'd like you to think about is, as we go through these various stages of history and how they viewed work, put in the back of your mind, do I see any reflection of that still today? That's kind of the question I want you to be mulling over as we go through these things. How are there hints of that particular attitude toward work displayed in today's society? And when I say today's society, I mean particularly here in the in the north, but I'm not in Canada anymore. In the yeah, in the States. Let's just go that way. We'll make it safe. And feel free to throw the Canadians under a bus, too. We're about the same. I'm needing to be thrown under the bus, I guess. Let's get to work. The first one there on your outline, number one, the classical view, the Greeks and the Romans. There are two foundations for Western civilization, the Greek and Roman, the classical period, as well as the Judeo-Christian. Those are some of the significant streams that have made us who we are. And so I'd like to go back to the Greeks first and just review very briefly a little bit of mythology. I don't know if you remember Eris, the goddess of strife. And one of her children was labor. Word came from one of the goddesses, but the particular goddess is significant. She's a goddess of strife. You can imagine how they viewed work just from that fact. But that's the goddess who gave birth to labor. Labor is not a blessing, it's a curse. And out of Pandora's box, we won't go through that whole story, but it's quite a fascinating little story. Punishment by Zeus, one of the things in Pandora's box is labor. So both work and labor, toil, is from the gods, but really from the negative side of the gods. And so as the Greeks viewed work, they saw it as a negative thing. Physical work is degrading to human dignity. A work is a curse that's below the dignity of a free person. And it's especially physical work that's below human dignity. That's just not what humans were designed for. We're to be like the gods. The gods don't work. The gods just think and ponder. And so those things became the greatest values in Greek society. As one fellow writes, work is forced on us by our embodied existence. When we die, we end up in oblivion. There's no trace of any of our work, our physical work, left. And what the Greeks wanted was to pass something on. And the way you do that is through philosophy or through great accomplishments where people remember you. Your name carries on for ages and ages. You have a continued influence. Plato spoke in terms of being enslaved to the body, and finally in death, we escape it. A very low view of the physical body. And we want to get beyond that, right? Be freed from the body. And Plato loved philosophy because it's in philosophy that your mind is finally detached from the physical needs and stuff you have to do to exist. You start thinking in pure, more pure thoughts. You're beyond physical distraction. So the upshot of that is physical work is degrading to human dignity. And the two main realms are really the slaves and the free. The slaves' job, they were basically maybe a level above animals. But they were designed by God, and I think Cicero says, even particularly those who are stooped over, think of Shrek now for a minute, they were designed to do physical work so that the elite don't have to work. And they can be real humans. They can contemplate. They can debate. They can do the work of the mind. And that's woven into the social structure. The slaves and artisans did their work. The elite devoted themselves to the exercise of the mind in art, philosophy, and in politics. That's similar to... Yeah, you see that little quote by Aristotle on your outline number one. To lead the life of a craftsman or trader is to lead a life devoid of nobility and hostile to perfection of character. And the Romans were basically in the same boat. Cicero writes, remember the great public speaker, he says, the toil of a hired man who is paid only for his toil and not for artistic skill is unworthy of a free man and is sordid in character. Trade on a small retail scale is also sordid. So you have these two, that's really the view of the classical period of work, fairly negative view. Work is designed so that those above, the elite, can actually do their thing. So that the glory of the mind. And so here I'm going to... Who shall be Zwingli? All right, well, this will be Knox. All right, there we go. So if I can... See, a puppet. That's even better than I had at home. All right, here's Zwingli. Okay, everybody say hi to Zwingli. You don't really have to do that, but just thank you, Eric. Thanks for playing along with me. So this is Zwingli speaking. You might say he represents the higher class... The elite here. Us humans don't work. It's below us. And that's what the slave like Knox here, that's what he does. Their job is to free us to be truly human, to contemplate and use our noggins, just like the gods do. Now, Knox, get to work. Make sure I don't have to think about work so I can escape the physical. I want to do real life. I want to be really human. I hope that helps a little bit. It helps me a lot when I can put a little perspective on what's going on. But think for just a second with me now. Are there any remnants of this philosophy in our day and age? How do you see that played out? I saw a head nod back in the Ron section. What do you see, Ron?
People of different professions get paid a lot more money than laborers who build the infrastructure of the country. It's kind of backwards.
Yep. So pay scale says a lot, Alex.
4-year college degree is considered required.
Right. If you want to be anybody, you need a four-year college degree. That's a minimum, even, right? Okay. Anything else?
And then we've also kind of developed a class now of immigrant labor who, you know, do these jobs that really we can't get Americans to do anymore.
Totally. My mother-in-law was in the hospital for a few weeks, as you probably know, and she she stayed in a hotel, and it's interesting how in the hotel you have a class system, and in places the cleaning people you don't talk to, you don't look at, they just do the work, and you ignore them. Tim Keller, in one of his lectures I listened to, said the same thing in the hospital. You wouldn't think it, but it's true. And you just observed as a pick on RN, sorry, Laura, but I think it was an RN walking down the hall, and she's a young lady, and there was a guy there who was on the cleaning staff. And he looked up to say hello, and what did she do? She looked past him. Why? What is that? Well, so we still have the same philosophy of there are rates of jobs, and we live that out still. And there's probably a ton of examples we could give, but I think that's probably enough. And I think it's worth thinking about. How do we ourselves live that out? You'll catch yourself doing it, no matter where you are. I remember a fellow who came to New Hope for a while, and he said, you know, I just don't seem like I can connect, because it was a mechanic. I work with my hands. That really made me pause. But it's worth thinking, what's our view of work? We looked at the idea of vocation, we'll get back to it, but if God dignified all work by himself being a worker, then we're obliged then to respect all who work hard, who work for God's glory. And that can be anywhere, whatever realm you work in. So that's a helpful little poke or reminder for us. And it's not that we want to say, well, we want to glorify manual labor over mental labor. I don't know how to distinguish the two, but both exist or are given to us as good gifts where we can glorify God in, and not one above the other. So if you're on the floor, you're in the office, so what? Glorify God in your work and treat each other with the dignity that you yourself would want to be treated. But now it feels like I'm preaching. So it's, I guess that's okay from time to time, right? Let's move on to the Middle Ages. About 500 to 1500. So a huge period. You've got all kinds of guys in this time period. You think of Augustine, he's in there. Think of Aquinas, he's in there. You got the one church, the Catholic Church, the medieval Catholic Church is in there. You got a whole bunch of rabbis, the Talmud's developed. I'm sure you could fill in a lot more blanks than I have. But the big shift in the medieval period is that it takes the classical view, sort of that dichotomy between the elite and the slave, and it puts a spiritual veneer on it. It gives it a spiritual twist now. So that the real spiritual people are the monks and the nuns, or those who give their time to contemplating, communing with God, whereas the workers, not slaves now, but the workers, they're second-rate citizens, or second-rate spiritual citizens. Their job is to free the others, support the monks, the nuns, the churches, and so on, to do the real work of contemplation. It's not just the medieval church. I think it's the easiest one to look at. But if we go back a little further, what I mean by sacred secular dichotomy is a division between holy things, maybe real spiritual people, and then the secular, normal work, running a fish and chip shop is not sacred. What's sacred is to be a pastor. But all other work is secular work. It's sort of poo-pooed, looked down on. It's not holy. It doesn't honor God. It's second rate. One of the rabbis, name is Rabbi Simeon, writes, physical work is condemned because it takes time away from the spiritual life. If people will only do the will of God, their work will be done by others. It doesn't leave a lot of hope for us who do the other work, does it? In the Jewish Talmud, it's a little bit longer of a quote, but halfway through, I think it really picks up. This is a little prayer. I thank thee, O Lord, my God, that thou hast given me my lot with those who sit in the house of learning. So in the synagogue, in the house of learning. And not with those who sit at the street corners. For I am early to work, and they are early to work. I am early to work on the words of the Torah, the Bible, and they are early to work on the things of no moment, of no consequence. I weary myself, and they weary themselves. I weary myself and profit thereby. They weary themselves to no profit. I run and they run. I run toward the life of the age to come. They run for the pit of destruction. You see a pretty clear dichotomy there between the worker and the meditator, right? The spiritual citizen. Under your second point, the classical view gives a spiritual cast to the classical view. And the sacred-secular dichotomy, that division between the sacred, the holy, and the worldly, the two categories are the truly religious dedicate themselves to serve God by contemplation, and the rest are second-class Christians who work to support the elite. Let me see, there's a couple of other... Have any quotes on yours? You don't, so you have to benefit from what I read. Eusebius, an early church father, there are two ways of life for the church. The above nature, beyond common human living, a life given to service of God alone, especially through contemplation. The other, humbler is not a word, well maybe it is, more humble, are the workers who have a secondary grade of piety attributed to them. See the same idea in the medieval church. Within the monastery or convent, the religious, who aimed at perfection, devoted themselves largely to contemplation, while outside, in the family, in the marketplace, in the field, and on the seas, the others kept the wheels of the work of the world running at the cost of condemning their souls to a second-best spiritual life. Physical work was done by the ascetics, so those who gave themselves to keeping the first commandment, that's sort of how they viewed it, but it was done really as a scourge to themselves. Because it was painful, it was an act more of penance than of glorifying God in their work. So if I can remember who's who, I think this was Zwingli here. We'll start with Knox. Morning, Knox. That's all you're going to get. But I wish I could be a monk. But I guess I'm resigned to a second-rate spiritual life. I'm just so distracted by my wife and kids. The cows need milking. I've got to plow the field. I'll never be a real Christian. I move over to Zwingli, the other side. I get too much fun out of this. Do I milk cows? Have a wife? Kids? No! I serve God. Real Christians give their lives to God by contemplating Him. Now get out, you're distracting me. Poor Knox gets knocked around a lot. And yeah, you knew that was coming, didn't you? It took me more time to think about what to name these guys. But now think again. With that, you might say, the spiritual veneer over that dichotomy, sacred and secular, where do you see hints of that in today's society? In the church, perhaps, or elsewhere? Nowhere. All right. One that struck me, a young fellow came to me from church here probably half a year ago and said, I've really been wrestling with what career to pursue. I want to honor God. And so I feel like I've got to be either a pastor or a missionary or something to do with the church. How would you answer that? I think you'd go right over here. Well, there's no dichotomy between those two. You can honor God in whatever job He's gifted you to do. You can stay at home, Dad. Well, let's not go there, okay? But I feel like I got to clarify that one. Well, I'll just go on. Whatever job it is, whether you're a mom at home, whether you're retired and you give yourself to serving the family and the church, does it make you a second-class spiritual citizen? The Bible says no. Glorify God in whatever I've called you to do. I think that's really freeing. What has God gifted you to do? Go do it with all your heart. Think about how you can love God, how you can love your neighbor in this. Or you may put other responsibilities that you just have to take care of. And so you can't do what would so fulfill your heart. You got to provide for a family. You're just... I'm probably getting distracted. But the best jobs for Christians are not being a pastor or a missionary. Those are good jobs. And if you feel inclined, great. But they don't glorify God more than another job. Peeling potatoes when I was a kid, does it glorify God more than when I was preaching? Do them both unto His honor and glory. And He's well pleased. And that's the big one here that I thought of as far as where we carried over some of this. The best jobs have to do with the church. Any comments on that? Yeah, Betsy.
I've actually heard people say, you know, that they prefer like pastors or elders to be praying for them because they have an in with God. They have like a hotline.
Give me a good line to answer that because I don't have one. have you heard that before? Sort of. I really want the pastor to visit, not an elder. Or I really want one of the elders to pray because they've got an in with God. Somehow there's just a notch above. But I suspect the people who sit closest to Jesus at the table when He comes again, or in the new heavens and new earth, are probably not going to be pastors, preachers, missionaries. Probably going to be someone we've never seen, never heard of, but someone who loved the Lord as they went about their work, as they went about their life, with their eye on Him, even though it didn't pay off. All right, any other comments?
One thing I see with young people these days, especially, I mean, my own sons, I think, are part of the mentality that I think it comes from coming of age at a time when the economy isn't really good, perhaps. But you see people worrying more about what kind of life they're going to lead than worrying about what they're going to do for a living.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's all part of it, but it's really not the focus.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's frustrating, but I hear it from my own sons, you know, is that, you know, this is what I want to be doing, this is how I want to live, and in the back of my mind is like, and how are you going to pay for that? But, you know, that's never their focus.
Right.
They always feel like that's going to come, you know. That,
right. Yeah, and I think we'll come back to that. I'm almost positive when we when I pick on Dan Adams in, I think it's the next section. Might be, I can't remember if it's a romanticism or the Enlightenment. That might be the Enlightenment, but because that is that's a growing movement again, where sort of the ideal. This is what I want out of life, and I'll have to. This is what I want to be, and how we get there. Well, we'll do what it takes. But Julie.
When we were doing the series on the Bible of literature, Uncle Steve addressed this whole topic of loving God with our whole body, soul, and mind. And he said the person who works with their mind, that's not all there is, to just love God with our mind. We should all be loving God as a whole person, with our hands, with our, you know, with all of us. And it was, I don't know, I thought it was very relevant.
So. Mm-hmm.
Just loving God in all.
Right. Yeah, and you can think, I'm sure, as you think through this, what are some of the biblical passages that would speak to this? Loving the Lord God with all your heart, soul, and mind. It doesn't say love the Lord God with all your logos, with all your mind. No, it's all of those. And you see that, I think, Betsy, you made that point in Genesis where Adam and Eve were called to do physical labor, but also mental labor. They were to name the animals. They were to be using their mind to be creative. That's before the fall, just like tilling the ground or gardening was there. I think of Jesus himself working for how many years? 14 till 30, before he did the work of his ministry. That's really, I think, helpful to be thinking those terms. Now, let me move to the Renaissance for a moment. Yeah, this is...
Yeah, I need to look at it. I am from Nigeria.
Mm-hmm.
and I was raised in church in Nigeria, and I was educated through the schools established by the missionaries. Okay, and the missionaries taught us science and they taught us the Bible. And I came to the United States to study chemical engineering and chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
And I had it in mind to pursue education based on the sound faith of Christ, to attribute my education to promote the kingdom of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
Then it turns out, and this is something very serious, that in the evangelical church in this country, the Bible and the work of Christ is interpreted in such a way as to give missionaries the highest spiritual level in terms of contributing to the kingdom of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
That is followed by pastors.
Mm-hmm.
And then that is followed by those who work in the Christian organizations.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So you will talk about devoting your entire being to serving Christ.
Mm-hmm.
The interpretation is still that those who go out as missionaries, mm-hmm. those who serve as pastors, and those who work in the Christian organizations mm-hmm. are doing something more spiritual
mm-hmm.
than those who go to study chemistry and chemical engineering.
Mm-hmm.
So the pastor of my church himself, when I went to talk to him in his office, he told me that because he knows that I studied the Bible and I tried to use it to promote the cause of Christ, he said that it would be better for me to go to a seminary and get a master's in divinity or something like that and go back to Nigeria. Because to him, he is a pastor. So he's doing something more spiritual and he coaches more people to serve Christ than to go and study chemistry and chemical engineering who are not quite on that level.
Right.
And what makes this very, very serious? Okay, because you mentioned Timothy, a fellow in New York, that
Keller.
He is very, very concerned about this issue too. Because what happens, okay, is that the Christians in this country, the evangelicals, okay, no longer encourage their sons and daughters to go and study chemistry, biology, and all these things. So in the end, okay, the church is not well, science is not well represented in the church.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I don't want to go for that, I'm okay, but from my own experience, I know that very, very well. My pastor tried to basically discourage me from studying chemistry and chemical engineering because he thought if I went to seminary, I would serve God in the most spiritual sense. So this is something that we have to learn. And then the Christian families, they prepare their daughters to be married to missionaries and pastors and so on, than to be married to chemists and chemical engineers.
I think one something that's helpful there is does a calling, whether it's a missionary or a chemist, glorify God more? I think that's the issue that I'm trying to hit on, because if you play that, it's the missionaries and pastors where the real glorifying God is. You have two systems. One really can glorify God, the other can't. With respect to the effect upon mankind, and you might say the advancement of God's kingdom from man to man, I think that's a different story. Yes, evangelists or pastors may have more effect as far as winning souls to Christ. And that's significant. That's an encouragement to pursue that field. And with respect to God, glorifying God, they both magnify Him the same. So that you don't have to be all dour, well, all I do is peel potatoes. No, peel potatoes for God's glory. He is magnified in that, just as someone in a different role is magnifying God in his role. I think that's the balance between the two. And what it does is it elevates all of us, when you're a chemist or a missionary, to pursue God with all your heart in your vocation. So people will see that and see something of Him in your work. That they'll see that the church cares about science just like it cares about the gospel, because He's made us a whole being. He created both the spiritual book and the natural book, right? He made them both. So we're to care about them both with great zeal. I think that's the balance that we're looking for. That's not to disparage the advancement of God's kingdom. That's significant. And I think, I don't know if you made that point, but in the West, I think that's something we would do well to pay more attention to fund well those who advance God's kingdom this way. Let me see here. The Renaissance and Reformation, 1400 to 1700. Here, in the Renaissance, the big thing is humanism. People become wonderful. You might say the magnifying of the humans. You could think of Michelangelo, his sculpture of David in immaculate, probably wrong word to use, but in wonderful detail. That's the Renaissance, the flowering humanism. And what they do then is they begin to assert the dignity of manual labor again, working with your hands. Their view of God shifted, and so did their view of work. And they move in parallel. No longer was God the passive, distant, pure mind. You can hear the classical there. God was conceived as a cosmic craftsman who, in an impressive display of wisdom and power, brought the entire universe into existence. And their view of work then begins to pick up on that. We're now, the craftsmen are honored. Those who work with their hands, they reflect this balanced, perhaps, view of God. Their idea of work expresses their confidence, their exuberance, unwittingly. It sings the praises of the kind of work at which they excelled. The individual, craftsman-like, the artistic. Their work required that hands touch material. They gave work the dignity the word craftsmanship carries today. That's broad strokes, humanism, or the Renaissance, and the elevation of the manual labor. The Reformation, I moved that a little further, it put it in a biblical context, and it rejected the sacred secular division where you've got first-class spiritual citizens and second-class spiritual citizens. We talked about the doctrine of vocation a couple of weeks ago, where it's God who calls us to whichever task is put in front of us, what we're gifted for, what we end up doing. If He is sovereign over all in His providence, then He puts in front of you that particular task you're called to do. And it's in your calling, then, that you glorify Him. The result of that is that all work then becomes elevated, where whether you're the farmer or the monk, all work now becomes for God's glory. I think we talked about the Protestant work ethic. That really is the outworking of this Reformation, reclaiming of the dignity of all work. Protestant work ethic is, listen, if God calls you to work, work for His glory, which means work hard, work diligently, use all your strength in your work, your mind in your work, and that produces a pretty good worker, because he's not working just to please his master. He's not, right, work unto the Lord. He's not working just to get ahead, to be successful. He's working for God's glory. And all of a sudden you've got these people who are diligent in their work, whether they get all the blessings and benefits of that or not, because they're serving the Lord Christ. That's the idea of the Protestant work ethic. That's going to come up significantly in the next section as well. Let me see if I can summarize that with our two little guys here. Knox, Zwingli. Right. Wow, you work with your hands? Artisans, you're an artisan as you smooth pillows and arrange blankets. Think of working in the hotel. And then if you go to Knox, some people used to scorn me because my work was below them. But I glorify God by cleaning hotel rooms. And since it pleases Him, I work hard and do my work well. A little summary of the Renaissance and Reformation. Let's see if there's any comments on that. This is where I'll pick on Dan Adams. I can tell him about it, don't worry. But any thoughts as far as the elevation? I think you could say correction. They threw too much away, but a correction where they elevate the view of working with your hands. Any ideas on that here?
I just see pride. Zwingli has a big nose. and Jesus' view of the Pharisees.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were the church leaders.
Mm-hmm.
And how did he view them? You know, and it was because of their pride, their view of themselves.
Right. Right. Yeah, I'm picking up on that pride idea. There's I think you can see that there's a pride in particular sectors of work today where they're elevated and you expect people to view them higher than they ought to. Emily, did you want to add something?
Yeah, just a thought. It reminds me of Nicaragua, like the whole community there, because everybody in their vocation, their whole purpose is to magnify Christ, like the Christians. And they, like the taxi drivers, have it written all over their car, like Jesus is Lord, and that's what they talk about when you sit down.
Mm-hmm.
And the doctor, too, like you think, like here in our culture, doctors are elevated in a way. But the doctor there, like, doesn't even have money for a car and spends a lot of his time going into the poor communities and just visiting them, and he's not getting paid for it, just to educate them. But it's interesting kind of what Billy was saying, like using your mind. Or if your vocation is to use your mind, using your hands too.
Mm-hmm.
On the other side of that, like using your hands, people who use their hands, using their mind and heart to proclaim Christ too.
Yeah. We get both together.
Yeah.
Ron.
I think it's worth thinking about also, it wasn't like a group of people sat around at each of these ages and said, how are we going to look at life? And then let's apply that and everybody applies to their. It's easy to look back and categorize history, but for instance, in the Middle Ages, there was danger everywhere, and so people gravitated towards those who had security, and so you were kind of forced into that. Well, they had, and the church was, they had land, they had money, they had stable,
yeah,
some stability through that,
yeah,
and so naturally they became like the overseers of things, and that they became more importance.
Right.
You know, and as far as the Renaissance, now things are free again, and people began to explore things, and we can look back at Tagno being prideful, but I think that might be us overstepping a bit. We're sort of using the category there. But the point, I think, that's deeper than that is, where was the church in these times? It's the failure of the church to maintain the outlook of what work is, not so much the people that they just sat around and decided to do the evil in that conscious way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I think one of the payoffs of actually walking through history for a minute is to see exactly, at least the first point you had, is Christians, or the church more broadly, often follows the philosophy of the age. You see that very clearly as we take these broad strokes. Things were really, in the Renaissance, their view of God changed. Why? Because life around them, the context in which they lived, allowed that. Things got a little bit easier. There was time to do craftsmanship and so on. Same with the Greek and Roman world. Why did the church have that view of work? Because that's the context in which they lived, which calls us to be very careful. It's hard for us to see today, because of where we live, we're too close to it to see how our view of work is affected by our culture. And one of the things I think it's not too hard to see is that in the West, we're one of the richest countries in the world. We are rich. Whether you're the poorest person here in this room, we're rich. And so we worship money. We do. We think, what can we do? We talk about what we can get. We have. That's one of the aspects. We just breathe it. We find our security in stuff. Do you worry about Ebola? Probably not very much. Because we've got the medical field, which is supported by how much. And that's wonderful. But we trust in money. It drives so much of what we do. It's hard to see that clearly. I'm speaking to me. So much of because we breathe this air, we don't see very clearly how our view of work has been affected. The idea of working for the weekend, I think, is a big deal here. And for us, too. We work for leisure. We work for rest. Work is a burden. Instead of no, work is something you do 5 days, 6 days a week to glorify God in. But that's not the culture we live in. I think that's a significant point. I think I'll cap that. Michael.
What do you mean about, I didn't understand your comment about taking on Dan Adams, and also in the next break you said, gave too much away.
In humanism, I meant humanism gave too much away, as in elevating the dignity of labor. But then they give away or they look down on I think what was learned, you might say, in the Reformation, where you're working for God's glory. That aspect's gone, and now the focus is on man. Pick on Dan Adams. I don't really mean I'm going to pick on him, but he put me onto something that I thought was relevant here. The idea of craftsmanship is making a comeback, and Dan Adams' point is one of his little things he'd like to do is to get into glass blowing. Like, why? What's the point? Utilitarian, right here. You know, there's no pragmatic reason for it. Well, because there's a segment of the younger generation that enjoys craftsmanship. All the microbreweries. Why? The crafting. There's even some movies that he told me one. I think it's called Somme or something like that. It's like about a winemaker. It's a craftsmanship. It's making a comeback, a real elevation of doing what you want, but doing it very well. That's sort of picking up a little bit on Tom's comment. Or you have an ideal and you want to do it very well. That's good. The idea of the craftsmanship is now an elevated thing. It's not just you blow glass, all that stinks, your lungs would be terrible and the heat and all this stuff. But no, there's an elevation of craft. And that's, I guess, that's good. Anyway, that's just where I was picking on Dan Adams.
Thank you,
Sean. Yep. We have about 3 minutes, which means I'm not going to get through the rest here. Let me hit the... What do you do when you're halfway through your notes, right?
Blame the artisans.
Yeah, blame the artisans. I think I'm just going to close it there. We'll look at the Enlightenment and the Industrial Revolution and then the Romantic period. Look at the last page for just a second. So that's my last page. The Information Age. I find this interesting. It just doesn't really fit, so I'll do it now. As we reflect on today, today's day and age as far as work goes, the Information Age has changed a bunch of stuff. And one of the things that has changed is that a lot of work now is knowledge work. It's not the hands-on, it's manipulating knowledge, or creating, using, or communicating knowledge as opposed to manual labor. So a couple of the payoffs of that are that work becomes a little bit more ambiguous. What exactly is your job? How many of you can describe your job succinctly to somebody else? Well, in part that's because it's in the range of knowledge. There's also a rise of mass connectivity in today's day and age. And that's going to affect a lot of things. One of the things it does is that distance is no barrier anymore, which means that you can go to Nigeria and take your work with you. And it's just as if you're right here. And there's no boundaries, which creates a lot of trouble, my opinion, in work. Because where does rest come in? Where do the boundaries... and people can ask more and more of you, and you can't say no. What do you mean you're going to be in Hawaii? Take your computer with you. Increased load of information, that the rate at which society... I just ran over that too quickly. Information, how many emails do you get a day? The average is 136 emails a day. How do you deal with that? The rate at which information comes to you, it affects how you think. You don't have time to think. Move on. If you go on the internet, how many pages do you visit? It's not one. You don't think about the one page. They want you to move it. That changes how we work. It changes how we think. The rate that society changes, no longer do ideas take years to go from one continent or one county to the next country. It can be in minutes. That shifts again how we think and how we work. I think that's probably enough. So those are some things I hope to come back to, because it's something we have to deal with as we work. How do you deal with the hectic pace in which our environment has thrown us? How do you take that and somehow work for God's glory or rest for God's glory in the middle of it? So that's all we've got time for today. We'll come back next time and finish up the other half. So why don't you go take a break? You can come up and pet Knox and Zwingli if you like. And we'll see you in about 10 minutes.